My name is Soraya Mia, and you are watching Awani Global. Now, last Sunday, a fire has actually devastated the Rohingya refugee camps in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, which left over 12,000 people homeless, and 6,000 of them were believed to be children. 2,000 shelters were burnt completely. Now, this was the second time fires has destroyed homes in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. Now, to get the bigger picture, the understanding about the problems facing the Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar is Lillian Phan, who is the chair of Rohingya Working Group Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network. Now, first of all, thank you so much, Lillian, for joining us on Awani Global. Okay, so let's just understand. I mean, this is not the first time, you know, from January 2021 to December 2022, there were several fires that happened in the Cox's Bazar camp. Now, what actually makes these camps prone to fires, Lillian?
It's actually a real tragedy what we're seeing in the camps in Cox's Bazar. And you're absolutely right. There have been multiple incidents of fire that have broken out in these camps from 2021, but even actually before that. So even since the big exodus into Bangladesh took place from 2017, there have been actually almost 100, or in some records, even more than 100 fires that have been recorded by the fire department in Cox's Bazar. And the very worrying thing actually is that many of them have actually been recorded as arson. So I think that this is something that is really alarming, which we need to take very seriously, because it is true that the shelters in Cox's Bazar in these camps catch fire very easily. Firstly, because of the nature of the materials that the shelters are built from. They are still living in bamboo, tarpaulin. You know, most of the things there are wooden. There's really very little concrete. So you're talking about camps which basically already now for many years have basically remained in an extremely volatile emergency type situation. So these shelters are extremely fragile, extremely flammable. So fires spread very quickly. There have, of course, been some incidents which have been by accident, you know, perhaps a cooking accident. But a vast number of these incidents have actually been recorded now as arson, including if it's highly suspected that this particular incident that took place on March 5th, which devastated Camp 11, which is in Balukali, in that larger area of Cox's Bazar, that is also is suspected to be a case of arson. And this is extremely alarming, because it really shows you that the situation of security in these camps is just deteriorating rapidly. And the victims, as you rightly said, you know, are very numerous, and a very large proportion, at least half of those victims, are in fact children.
Right. With what you just said, there are many questions, you know, to follow up on this. As you said, there are still investigations going on to determine the true cause of the fires. But right now, who is actually responsible, you know, for the livelihood of the over a million Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar? Maybe you can answer that first.
So the government of Bangladesh obviously has been extremely generous to allow so many, you know, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees enter into their territory and basically grant a temporary shelter. However, the government of Bangladesh is not the only one that's being basically responsible for assisting those refugees. It's actually a very wide range of stakeholders, including the United Nations, including international NGOs, including the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, including local organizations in Bangladesh as well, and even organizations or networks rather that are mobilized by Rohingya refugees themselves. You know, everyone's really trying to do their part. Unfortunately, of course, that entire response has also been declining. So I think that it's also this question of, you know, how long can you actually have a protracted displacement situation like this? You know, in Cox's Bazar, we're really talking about the largest refugee camps in the world over here, you know, right actually on the doorstep of ASEAN, caused by an ASEAN country. And we don't have, you know, long-term solutions to that. I mean, it's an incredibly unsustainable situation to expect that anyone's livelihood and, you know, well-being can be sustained by an international response like this for too long. So I think, you know, that's the question. It's not an easy answer. Nobody's really ultimately responsible for it. Ultimately, the responsibility actually is on Myanmar to, you know, stop the persecution of Rohingya and take the Rohingya back.
Yeah, talking about, you know, sustainable aid or assistance for the Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar, the World Food Program has actually announced a cut in the food aid for the Rohingya refugees beginning March 1st. So this was because of lack of funding. How can this impact the already devastating situation by the people in the refugee camps? What will actually happen?
What we're really fearing is that there will be a large increase in basically negative coping mechanisms to deal with the cut in food rations. There's already restrictions on livelihoods for Rohingya refugees there. You know, they can't really work. They are very highly dependent on assistance, including on food assistance. So the cut in rations is really going to result, we fear, in, unfortunately, more negative coping mechanisms, which could be anything from basically trying to use smuggling routes, you know, trying to use smugglers to get out of the camp, child marriage. This is another thing that we see, a very high incidence of as well, basically. Rohingya parents trying to lessen the burden that they face. Unfortunately, even things like prostitution, we may see that, you know, it's a very, very alarming situation. And we just are extremely worried that we're just going to see an already incredibly vulnerable population, you know, fall into even further vulnerability and also fall prey to, more and more basically networks of criminality that unfortunately would like to prey on such people.
Right, Lillian. So before we move on to more of like international, the international community's role in assisting the Rohingya refugees, a little bit more about the situation of the fire that has hit the camp, Camp 11 specifically, last Sunday. How will the recovery cost actually further strain the aid assistance to the vulnerable community over there?
It is going to put a very large strain. I mean, we're talking about a response which is already severely underfunded. The United Nations and partners have basically just recently made their appeal for the latest joint response plan. The last joint response plan was already massively underfunded. I'm trying to get the figures, but it was actually, yes, for 2022, it was $120 million underfunded. For this year, they're asking for $876 million. And, the prediction is that that's also going to be very severely underfunded. So that was before the fire. And we're talking about now an additional, enormous amount of needs that are going to have to be met. And this is in a climate, of course, as well, where there's really a decline in international funding. You know, the humanitarian donors, there's donor fatigue. There are other crises such as Ukraine, which are taking up a lot more international aid resources at the moment. So it's not an easy situation at all. So we are extremely worried that, this crisis, this fire plus the larger crisis of Rohingya displacement in Bangladesh is not going to get adequate assistance or attention.
That's right. But I also saw some reports of that there are countries actually, pledging some support to the Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar. But is this enough? As you mentioned just now, the UNHCR and the partners, including the Bangladesh NGOs, are seeking for $876 million to assist this vulnerable group. Is this enough to actually, have them more or less dependent on humanitarian aid? Is this sustainable? If not, then how?
It's not sustainable at all. I mean, I think that's really the worry. So number one, this is an appeal for aid. It's not an appeal for a sustainable solution, right? This is humanitarian aid appeal, which is never sustainable. It's never a solution. Even if you get that full amount, you're not finding solutions really. You're sort of, really patching up, a very desperate situation and trying to respond to basically almost a protracted emergency, if you like. That doesn't solve things. The fact is they won't even get that. They may not even get half of that they're appealing for. So you can just imagine we're not even halfway there in terms of meeting extremely basic needs. What more in terms of finding solutions? And in the end, humanitarian aid is not the solution, right? I mean, you really need to talk about solutions which come from political solutions, solutions of recognition of identity, solutions of facilitation of voluntary, dignified, and safe repatriation when that's possible at a time when Rohingya, could may finally get citizenship in Myanmar. So those are political solutions. which humanitarian aid will never be able to address.
Talking about, you know, the roles of governments or policies to actually ease the situation. So taking a step back, you know, Rohingyas are actually not declared as Myanmar citizens under the Myanmar 1982 citizenship laws. How does this actually impact not only the Rohingyas, but also the countries taking Rohingya refugees, including Malaysia?
It's really the basis of discrimination against Rohingya, and you know, the very basis of the absolute denial of human rights that the Rohingya have been facing for decades now really stems from that. It stems from the fact that there's no recognition of citizenship in Myanmar for Rohingya. And this is something which came really, as you rightly said, through the 1982 citizenship law. You know, prior to that, there was a recognition of citizenship for Rohingya. There were pathways to nationality. That was taken away from them. And the fact that there's been no citizenship for so long, you know, it's made them the most vulnerable, I would argue, you know, displaced community and one of the most vulnerable communities in the world because of the lack of access for so long to basic rights like education, healthcare, you know, freedom of movement, even freedom of, you know, the right to family life, right? Even to have a family and have children. Basic things, which you know, no human being should be you know, having to face. Basic right to dignity, and that impacts I mean, it makes them more vulnerable. So even in a situation where someone becomes a refugee, if you compare a refugee from a country like where should we say? I mean, Afghanistan or Syria. You know, they're extremely vulnerable too, but they've very likely had an education. They've very likely had access to a level of healthcare. In some cases, even very good. Healthcare for a period of time. You know, they've of course had to flee a conflict and a war, but you're not facing the same level of, you know, basically, you know, absolute denial of human rights at every level for such a long time. Where else with Rohingya, you know, they've been in survival mode, really facing genocide, facing persecution, facing, you know, one violation after another. So that entire generations have grown up deprived of any form of human rights. So it is very challenging. It does make it difficult also, I think, in our case, as a country that hosts Rohingya refugees as well as other refugees, even though we don't yet have a framework for doing so. But it does make it difficult because, for example, entry into our country is always done in a way which is illegal, which means that, you know, we come face to face basically with immigration restrictions. Whereas with other countries, even like Syria, Palestine, you know, many other Muslim countries, very often people could come here with a visa on arrival, with a legal passport, and then perhaps overstay. And I think that is a big difference because our government tends to recognize, you know, maybe not legally, but we recognize that level of persecution. And I would argue that we're a little bit more comfortable with that, you know, in because we understand the humanitarian needs and the need to have some protection from war. But I think it makes it very difficult for Rohingya specifically because of that inability to even, you know, to even travel. People don't have passports. You don't have an identity. There's no identity cards. You don't have a passport. The modes of even trying to flee are so much more, you know, are so much more unrecognized, but also so much more dangerous. And I think if you're talking about it from a human cost, the level of risk that Rohingya take, you know, just to flee from terrible situations is absolutely devastating and really, really, really alarming. And, you know, the fact that you're seeing more and more children, more and more women, elderly people, you know, trying to leave terrible situations, including the situation in Bangladesh. And I think this is one thing that we in Malaysia have to recognize. You know, the persecution and the danger is not only in Myanmar, it's in Bangladesh, as we can see as well. In these camps, they are not secure. They are getting more and more insecure. And this is one of the reasons why Rohingya are trying to leave and trying to flee, because the situation is so untenable in the camps as well.
Mm-hmm. So how can Malaysia make this easier for, you know, like as a host country, Bangladesh, Malaysia, how can they make it easier to assist these Rohingya refugees? Framework you mentioned just now, what kind of framework perhaps that we can look at, you know, the Malaysian government?
Lillian? I would say that the first thing is that the Rohingya you know, refugee crisis will never be solved by one country, and it should never be, it's not possible for this to be the responsibility of one country, right, to, you know, take on. And I know that our government also is very concerned that we're sort of bearing a disproportionate burden, if you like, or responsibility. But I would say that what our government should be doing is actually pushing really at the international and regional level for much more serious, practical, action-oriented dialogue on this crisis, and really coming up with a regional plan that does deliver some level of regional protection, but also shares responsibility. And, you know, this is all language which, is very nice to say at the international platforms, but actually it translates usually into very little at the in actual regional dialogues. You know, we can't just keep saying we're going to wait for Myanmar to, you know, take Rohingya refugees back, because that will take, you know, it could take 20 years from now. We really do need a little bit more urgency, a sense of urgency to come up with a plan. And it shouldn't be just one country. You know, we certainly do need to make things better here. There's certainly things that we can do, simple things, you know, the right to work, for example, some basic documentation, right to education. Those are things we can do. But we also, of course, don't want to be in a position where we're the only country that's doing that, right? And we do need to have much more responsibility on other, you know, shared responsibility from countries in the region. We do need to have a real dialogue with Bangladesh as well. And of course, you know, at the ASEAN platform and even the other international platforms, the OIC, the UN, and others, there has to be a lot stronger action, much, much stronger action on Myanmar. Yeah, you know, I don't think it's tolerable, that we sort of take this position where we have been quite outspoken, but there's more that we can do. You know, there's a lot more that we could be pushing for. There's a lot more action that we could be taking to, somehow try to push for some much more serious change in Myanmar, which, you know, at this current point is really descending into a failed state.
Yes, that point is definitely, I agree strongly with the regional plan. And now talking about, you know, like the ASEAN leaders' roles, it has been 6 years since the brutal crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. And now the crisis is even worse after the 2021 military coup. So, ASEAN leaders have been having several dialogues and several meetings. And in fact, all of these nations have actually agreed to the 5-point consensus, including Myanmar. But is this 5-point consensus actually enough to create meaningful change for the crisis in Myanmar?
So, I would say that the 5-point consensus is broad enough that if there was serious action being taken, it could be done. The issue is that there's no real implementation mechanism, and there's no real monitoring mechanism. There's no real, there are no real timeframes and benchmarks to actually ensure that this is implemented, and there are no consequences for not implementing it, right? So I think that it needs to have teeth. There's no point having this 5-point consensus and, you know, just year after year, you know, having a dialogue with, stakeholders in Myanmar and saying, you know, it would be nice if you implement this. I mean, there really has to be some consequences about not implementing it, and some really clear timeframes and benchmarks that you can monitor and, track progress or lack of progress. And I think that ASEAN leaders, at least, quite a number of the ASEAN leaders, there's some division on this, but at the same time, I do actually see that there has been a strengthening in language. But it's not enough to just have strong language. We really do need, we need to have teeth. We need to add teeth to this. That's one thing. The second thing is, it's not going to be enough, right? I mean, as strong as you make the ASEAN 5-point consensus, that's not going to solve everything. So I do think that bilaterally, some countries in the region are going to have to make some tough decisions. Perhaps we may be ready for this. I hope that we're ready to, you know, think about some bolder decisions about, whose side we're on, and, you know, how we're going to basically, try to facilitate some, lasting change in Myanmar. This is really not a situation that can be resolved easily. It will take years. And in the meantime, put in place some actual regional frameworks that can protect people who are fleeing from such a disastrous, catastrophe that's taking place in Myanmar.
No, Lillian, when you say vulgar decisions or stronger decisions, what do you mean by that?
So I would say, for example, meeting the different stakeholders in Myanmar. So, for example, there are, there's the SAC, which is basically led by the military. There is also the NUG that is, you know, the National Unity Government, we need to be having open dialogues with these groups. We need to be, you know, much, much bolder. We need to be facilitating that type of dialogue. I think that, you know, Malaysia has the basically view and, you know, the position in Myanmar, in ASEAN, that we've taken strong stands on Myanmar for years now. We should be still continuing to call and, you know, basically facilitate a lot more dialogue at the regional level. We should be taking stands on pushing for regional frameworks on, you know, making sure that refugees are protected. We should be taking stands on ensuring that humanitarian aid is sent into Myanmar with monitoring where that aid is going. There are lots of things we can be doing. We should even be questioning if our businesses should be still investing in Myanmar. You know, these are the types of actions that we could be taking, right? Without getting to the point of, you know, maybe granting recognition to one or another side, because that's a very strong, you know, position to take, and I'm not sure we'd be ready for that. But there are lots of things that we could be doing. And I think really the business dialogue is important, right? You know, Myanmar is a country that was starting to open up. There are lots of businesses in the region, including from Malaysia, that were starting to invest in this country. Where's the dialogue on that? You know, where is the ethical dialogue on should we still be investing? Are we pulling out? You know, are we going to start, you know, really trying to send stronger messages to Myanmar that we don't accept this, and, you know, we can't tolerate the level of, you know, insecurity that is being imposed on Myanmar citizens and, you know, people in Myanmar any longer. It's affecting the regional stability. You know, this is not something which is any more justifiable to claim that it's an internal issue. It's very clear that this is a regional issue, and internationally, it's one of the biggest crises in the world right now. So, you know, let's really get out of that sort of, oh, this is an internal issue in Myanmar, we can't, you know, say anything. No, we have to say things. We really should be taking up that mantle. And I hope that Malaysia will stand up to that challenge.
Right. We have just about 2 minutes left. You know, when you talk about actions that Malaysia can take, or the neighboring countries, neighboring ASEAN countries can take, many countries are actually saying that there is this non-interference policy, you know, within ASEAN countries. So have we reached the point of actually having to take action such as sanctions or whatnot? Or is there still room for dialogue? And, you know, how else can we actually facilitate? Is this through different countries, like maybe Thailand could have better dialogues? Or what do you think about this, Lillian?
Well, I think that we are at the point where we need to think about some, you know, much more serious action. I do think economic, I don't know if sanctions is the way to do it, but definitely some level of cutting certain ties, right? If whether we want to call it sanctions or not. That could also just be businesses deciding to withdraw. You know, it doesn't have to be maybe a whole government instruction to say, you know, we declare that we instruct all of the businesses to withdraw, but businesses should be doing it on their own, really, right? So I think that it's something where we need a kind of, you know, a movement where there's solidarity from all of society. We should be, you know, addressing this because the burdens do fall on us. I mean, if myself as a director of an NGO, right, for example, you know, I'm leading this working group at the regional level as well. There's such a disproportionate pressure right now and, you know, responsibility on organizations like mine, which are, you know, small, not very well funded. You know, we are trying to patch these gaps, basically. We're trying to, you know, basically address enormous problems of serving the needs of vulnerable refugees who are coming into this country because there's no framework. I mean, it's not sustainable, right? It's a burden on us. If we didn't have to do that, we would prefer not to have to do that. It would be much better to put resources elsewhere. It's really a recipe for disaster by not addressing these issues. And it's not just for the Rohingya. I mean, we're talking about, you know, so many groups in Myanmar. Every single group in Myanmar right now is facing risk, right? Maybe not at the same level of, you know, that level of genocide, but, you know, every ethnic minority is facing risk. You know, there is a renewed conflict in so many parts of Myanmar. Even in the cities, there has been fighting. There are people who are fleeing from Yangon. There are people fleeing from Mandalay. I mean, this is, it's really, you know, at the state of almost civil war, right? And you know, a real breakdown of the entire society, which is in the heart of ASEAN. It's affecting so many countries in our region, ASEAN as well as non-ASEAN. You know, India's affected, Bangladesh is affected. we can't just continue to, you know, have, you know, discussions where, which really have no tangible outcome, right? It's not feasible anymore. And it's really affecting regional security and human security as well.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much, Lillian, for sharing your thoughts and for your time. That was Lillian Fan, Chair of Rohingya Working Group, Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network. My name is Saraya Mia, and you are watching Awani Global. Thank you.